Psalm 40, verses 1 to 11. Thanksgiving for deliverance and prayer for help. Such is the Christian story. I waited patiently for the Lord. He inclined to me, heard my cry. He drew me up from the desolate pit, out of the miry bog, and set my feet upon a rock, making my steps secure. He put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise to our God. Many will see and fear and put their trust in the Lord. Happy are those who make the Lord their trust, who do not turn to the proud, to those who go astray and after false gods. You have multiplied, O Lord, my God, your wondrous deeds and your thoughts towards us. None can compare with you. Were I to proclaim and tell of them, they would be more than can be counted. Sacrifice and offering you do not desire, but you have given me an open ear. Burnt offering and sin offering you have not required. Then I said, here I am. In the scroll of the book it is written of me, I delight to do your will, O my God, and your law is written in my heart. I have told the glad news of deliverance in the great congregation. See, I have not restrained my lips, as you know, O Lord. I have not hidden your saving help within my heart. I have spoken of your faithfulness and your salvation. I have not concealed your steadfast love and your faithfulness from the great congregation. Do not, O Lord, withhold your mercy from me. Let your steadfast love and your faithfulness keep me safe forever.
This is Esther 9, verses 20 to 28. Mordecai recorded these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, enjoining them that they should keep the 14th day of the month of Adar, and also the 15th day of the same month, year by year. As the days on which the Jews gained relief from their enemies, and as the month that had been turned for them from sorrow into gladness, and from mourning into a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and gladness, days for sending gifts of food to one another and presents to the poor. So the Jews adopted as a custom what they had begun to do, as Mordecai had written to them. Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them, and had cast Pur, that is, the lot, to crush and destroy them. But when Esther came before the king, he gave orders in writing that the wicked plot that he had devised against the Jews should come upon his own head, and that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. Therefore these days are called Purim, for the word Pur. Thus, because of all that was written in this letter, and of what they had faced in this matter, and of what had happened to them, the Jews established and accepted as a custom for themselves and their descendants and all who joined them, that without fail they would continue to observe these 2 days every year as it was written and at the time appointed. These days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation, in every family, province, and city. And these days of Purim should never fall into disuse among the Jews, nor should the commemoration of these days cease among their descendants.
Good morning. I'm going to preface this by saying that I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about other people's religious traditions, which is always something to do humbly, because there's a big chance of misrepresenting something you're not thoroughly familiar with. So enter into this humbly. Years ago, I visited Israel and the Palestinian territories on a delegation with Christian peacemaker teams. We visited a home of a Palestinian family in the West Bank and heard about their family history. So at one point when we were chatting with one of the younger men, I don't remember his name, so I'm going to call him Yusuf, he put his arm around one of the older men there, who was his uncle, and started teasing him. "This is the guy that tried to drown me. Are you crazy? I'm the reason you're alive." "Well, just barely. I'm lucky to be breathing." So clearly this was an old joke between them. And Yusuf told us the story behind it. He and his family had lived in what is now the West Bank, so the region just west of the Jordan River, for generations. And then in 1967, when he was a baby, the land belonged to the country of Jordan. Then war broke out between Israel and some of its neighboring Arab countries. And when that fighting started, the family had fled east, further into Jordan. So when the brief war was over, this was the Six-Day War, if you remember, Israel was claiming all the territory west of the Jordan. So what had been their home in Jordan was now their land in Israeli territory. And the Israeli government was also claiming the right to take over any land or homes that had been abandoned. And at the same time, Arabs were not being allowed to cross at the official checkpoints that had been established, cross into what was now Israeli territory. So the family decided that the only way to get back to their home was to sneak across the Jordan River at night, under cover of darkness. And the task of carrying baby Yusuf fell to his uncle. So Yusuf swears that he remembers his face barely being above the water, possibly being in the water, that his uncle wasn't being very careful, and his uncle teases him that he should have just dropped him in the river. But in the end, they reach their home, and they live there still. So it's a story that stuck with me. The first, because I was so struck by the implications and the irony of having to sneak into the promised land, but also because I admired how this deeply traumatic event had become a source of humor and of family bonding and a sort of gentle defiance and joy in the face of all that loss and pain. So today I'd like to spend some time reflecting on the power of stories of deliverance and grace, especially ones that we tell as a community, stories with an element of surprise. Stories in which, like it says in Esther, sorrow was turned into joy and their mourning into a day of celebration. Of orphans who become queens, of drunkards who become good fathers, of babies in stables who become kings. So I'd like to start by exploring the story of Esther that we began last week, and specifically the storytelling tradition that I referenced in the children's story, the Purim Spiel. And then I'd like to talk a little bit about a contemporary example of that kind of storytelling in a Christian setting, and then invite us to reflect on our personal and communal stories here at Jubilee. So, Esther. Steve added so much interesting context to this story last week and delved a bit into the Purim celebration, so I'm going to start with a super quick review of the book. It's set during what we refer to as the exile. So Jerusalem had been conquered by the Babylonians, the temple was destroyed, and many people were taken into captivity further east in the heart of the empire. And so this was around 600 BC. Well, less than a century later, Persian Empire in turn conquered the Babylonians, took over land that had previously been theirs, and they in general were more sympathetic to the religious minorities in their empire. And they allowed those Jews who wanted to return to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple and live there to do so. But not everyone returned. And the ones who stayed tended to be wealthier, maybe less pious, perhaps more assimilated. As Steve pointed out, they were not really like a shining example of God's special chosen set apart people. So in this setting, in the royal city of Susa, also known as Shushan, the king decides to choose a new wife, a new member of his harem, basically. So he has a little The Bachelor contest. And Hadassah, who's better known by the name Esther, at the urging of her cousin Mordecai, joins the contest. And she's an orphan. Mordecai has raised her. She's chosen, and it's her courage that eventually saves the Jews throughout the empire from genocide. The king's pompous and evil nobleman, who wants to be prime minister, Haman, is enraged that Mordecai will not bow down to anyone but God, and he decides to get revenge on all the Jews and tricks the king into decreeing their destruction. Esther, however, encouraged by Mordecai, cleverly maneuvers just the right moment to reveal Haman's plot and also that she herself is Jewish. And the Jews end up being saved from being wiped out. Mordecai is honored, and Haman is either hung from the gallows or impaled on a stick, depending on the translation. So this is a good time to point out the part of the story that we usually gloss over. The king did not just reverse the decree that all Jews should be killed. Rather, he gave them permission to fight back. So according to the Bible, this resulted in them killing tens of thousands of people and Haman and his sons being killed in a really gruesome way. So stories are complicated. Sometimes one person's day of mourning is another's day of joy. One group's struggle for a homeland leaves another exiled. And of course, we can't help wondering why God would let any innocent person suffer. But stories are not systematic theology. So today, the story of Esther is remembered in the Jewish holiday of Purim. And that name is the plural of Pur, or the lots, which were cast to determine the month in which the Jews would be destroyed. And it is celebrated all over the world. As Steve told us last week, there are special scrolls that the book of Esther is read from. It's one of the five books of the Megillah, which are five books of the Bible. And the retelling is rowdy. Boo when Haman is mentioned, and the children wear costumes, sometimes the adults too. There's carnivals, there's special treats like Hamantaschen, which is supposed to look like the kind of hat that Haman wore. There's lots of alcohol. A really recent tradition has been street parades and floats, especially in Israel. It's one of those holidays that's found in a lot of cultures in which all the traditional rules of propriety and social hierarchy just kind of get upended. So Purim fits the formula for a Jewish holiday, as the old joke goes. They tried to destroy us, we won, let's eat. But for many centuries, it was considered a minor holiday and kind of a sketchy one. And it didn't necessarily include all the components of today's Purim festivities. So first came the biblically mandated tradition of reading the scroll aloud, giving gifts, remembering the poor, feasting, and drinking. But it wasn't until the Middle Ages in Europe that the plays and the costumes we now associate with Purim spread across the continent. And so that brings us to the tradition that I was talking about in the children's story, the Purim Spiel. So Spiel is the Yiddish word for skit or play. And so now, in addition to reading the story straight up aloud, many synagogues and religious schools also perform this kind of comedic, theatrical retelling of the Purim story with costumes and music. It usually has some sort of parody of well-known songs or musicals. It's a way to kind of poke gentle fun of maybe the synagogue leaders or teachers, you know, local people, and not so gentle fun sometimes at current events and current leaders, figures of power. So synagogues often will write or obtain a new script each year. You can go online and find lots of scripts. So I did some Googling, and last year in Columbus, some of the Purim spiels on offer were a Mary Poppins one, The Muppets Take Purim, and this is my favorite, Shushanian Rhapsody, featuring the music of Queen. There are Star Wars Purim spiels, Hamilton Purim spiels, and this is pushing the limits of God's sense of humor, I think. The Book of Esther, according to Taylor Swift. Some synagogues even release trailers for their Purim spiels to build anticipation and attendance, and at some places it's a big fundraiser, too. So we're just going to watch a little snippet of one of them. I really debated between this Billy Joel one, called Megillah Man, and a Hamilton one. The Hamilton one is a little, it was just easier to find the right place in the YouTube one. The Billy Joel one had really great choreography and costumes. And Jake told me, Mama, nobody but us is going to understand how amazing the Hamilton one is, because it is a pretty amazing parody of lots of lines from Hamilton and the characters and the costumes. But this part is like the finale of the story. It's right at the end. So they've been using the Hamilton music to retell it, And we'll just watch a little bit of it. If you can, yeah. I don't know if you have sound there.
Because history has its own.
So you see Haman in the middle with his hat, and then Esther's there. In the, Esther and the king are there at the end.
History has its own.
That's Vashti in the red, and Mordecai in the...
Esther is a Mordecai.
Esther hasn't been forgotten. We punished Haman for his crimes and foiled all his plotting.
And our story isn't nearly done, but just you wait.
What's your name, miss?
Esther, niece of Mordecai.
Okay, we're good. Thank you. I know. We could watch Purim Spiels for a long time.
Happy Purim!
Okay, it's done. You can stop it. Thank you. So this tradition began and caught on in the European Middle Ages. And historians have all kinds of things to say about the origins of Purim in Jewish performance traditions and general European festivals like Carnival in Venice. But why did this type of play become so ubiquitous in a matter of a few centuries, which before mass media was pretty quickly? Was it because the Jews were doing so well that they had time to sit around and be merry and do frivolous things like make costumes and funny jokes? No. Anti-Semitism has always festered beneath the surface of European life, and in times of hardship, it becomes more overt. And the Middle Ages were pretty hard. They were pretty hard for everybody. So, for example, the 1300s, which was when the Purim Spiel was sort of in its early stages and starting to become a big tradition. If you remember the 1300s, or remember reading about them, it was not a great time to be alive for anyone. It's the same time that the Black Death was wiping out huge swaths of the population. So there was plague and misery. And if you were Jewish, there was being blamed for this plague. In a time of catastrophe, the Jews became the scapegoats in a lot of places. And there were a lot of conspiracy theories about they were the ones that had started the plague. If you look up the Wikipedia article on this, it is a huge catalog of massacres and pogroms. Basel, Provence, Barcelona, Strasbourg, thousands burnt alive, thrown into the Rhine, hundreds of communities entirely wiped out. So in this setting, this is when the Purim Spiel catches on. And I think it was because the communities telling the story saw themselves reflected in it. The threat of genocide was very real. They knew what persecution was. They had seen people they loved killed, and yet somehow the community as a whole had not been wiped out, not because of their own righteousness, but because of a God who turns sorrow to joy even in the midst of catastrophe. And telling that story with humor became a way of reclaiming their own dignity and who they were. So despite being looked down on as kind of questionable because of its revelry and riotousness, the popularity of Purim and the Purim Spiel specifically continued to grow. It was celebrated in the ghettos of Polish cities and in the concentration camps and in post-war orphanages. Yad Vashem, which is the Israeli Holocaust Museum, if you look online, it has a really haunting collection of photos from this time of Purim celebrations, hungry-looking children in costumes in the ghettos that would soon be liquidated. At Buchenwald, the prisoners squirreled away scraps of paper so that they could write from memory the Megillah, the Book of Esther, and read it aloud on Purim. At Dachau, as we heard, Haman became Hitler in a covert Purim spiel with costumes made from cement sacks. Purim was celebrated defiantly and fiercely, and despite the haunting question of why a merciful God would allow the story of so many communities to not end in joy. I think it was Lynn Miller who said in a recent sermon here that humor is what the powerful fear most because they have no way to fight it. So joy and the power of communal storytelling can't be destroyed with the sword. So as I was preparing for today and watching too many Purimspiel videos and reflecting, I was trying to think if there's anything analogous to this in the Christian community. Christians as a whole don't have this sort of communal memory of being threatened with annihilation, although particular groups of Christians, including Mennonites, may have some of those memories. But it wouldn't really be appropriate for us to pretend that the community as a whole does. We also kind of have to wrestle with the fact that Purim evolved in large part as a response to atrocities committed in the name of Christ. But the theme of God's deliverance and surprise doesn't stop with the Hebrew Bible, with what Christians call the Old Testament. In fact, it's also what Christianity is all about. From the very minute Jesus enters the scene, he confounds our ideas of what a Messiah and king should look like, a baby born to humble parents among animals, worshiped by lowly shepherds and foreigners, a king who eats with prostitutes and tax collectors, who offers redemption to all. So it's appropriate that the most analogous thing I could think of, the story that we tend to dramatize in a communal way, is the Christmas story in children's pageants. We haven't had a Christmas pageant here for many years, but I think many of us have memories of getting to play an angel or a shepherd or maybe even Mary and Joseph themselves in a reenactment of this story of wonder. And I think we can look outside our own Christian community too, to ones that may have something to teach us about this sharing stories of redemption. I was really struck by an article that appeared in the Mennonite 2 years ago called El Programa Navideño, the Christmas Program, Christmas and the Stories We Tell Ourselves. So this was written by Felipe Hinojosa, who wrote about growing up in a Mexican-American church pastored by his father. And I knew Felipe a little bit from MCC. He's my age, probably a little younger. And he grew up in this very poor but very tight-knit community in South Texas, where his father was the pastor of a small Mennonite church. And so in the article, he has this sort of nostalgic look at the children's pageants that they would do at the church every year. But his experience also included something else. It was El Drama de los Adultos, which was the drama that the adults put on every year. So there'd be the children's story, and then there would be the drama of the adults. And I'm just going to read it from what he wrote, because he's a really good writer. Los hermanos knew how to put on a show. Nothing compared to the preparation, the production level, the scenes, and the character angles with their fancy stage right exits. El Drama de los Adultos had it all. And every year it was essentially the same play, maybe different characters, a different timeline, but the drama was always about this alcoholic father who wasn't paying attention to his family, a tired and hardworking mother, and the church group that came in at just the right moment and how things got turned around. There were tears, real ones, dramatic cuts that left us wondering if this would be the year the family wouldn't make it and the father's alcoholism would bring everyone down. But every year the actors hit their marks, and every year another family was saved. Year after year, hermanos and hermanas turned in Oscar-worthy performances as the leader of the church elder board turned himself into an unrecognizable drunk, and some of our strongest hermanas transformed into weak housewives in need of rescuing. In the span of about 15 minutes, we witnessed the reformation of machismo and the strengthening of a woman who simply had had enough. So in these plays, there would always be, he says, a turning point right after the church group prays for the woman in her home. And then right after that, she makes the decision to attend church without him, to break the norm and move on with her life for the sake of her children. As the drunk husband makes a dramatic entrance, he's met by his wife, who calmly yet clearly lets him know, si tú no quieres ir a la iglesia, yo y mis hijos sí vamos a ir a alabar a Dios. If you do not want to go to church, my children and I are still going to go praise God. The drunk husband, wobbling on stage with the customary unbuttoned shirt and the disheveled look, is surprised and usually responds by ignoring his wife. We were transfixed. The same babies that were, for whatever reason, always make noise in Latino churches as if their lives depended on it, were even quiet at this point. And by the end of the drama, not only does the husband vow to give his life to Christ, he also makes the stunning declaration that God has called him to ministry, and he's going to start a church. Not a dry eye in the room. We all knew the ending, but it didn't matter. You see, that was my dad's story, and the story of countless other Mexican men who had turned toward the gospel and away from the bottle. We'd all seen it. Destroyed homes, grieving spouses, abusive fathers. I can think of at least 5 or 6 hermanos in our church who all shared similar stories of turning away from alcoholism and returning to their family and the church. We loved this program because it was us, neatly packaged in the nuclear family that many of us longed for, and with a female lead we all recognized, a woman fighting for her family. I had friends in single-parent homes, friends whose home situations were rough, friends who, even with both parents at home, rarely felt the love they deserved, and even those of us in good and stable families had friends who struggled with a rough life at home. But everyone found something to relate to in this play, he writes, because the storyline reminded us that we are all redeemable. So later on in the article, he talks about how the church that he goes to now doesn't do anything like this, and how he misses being part of a church that narrates its own story back to its people so that we can see ourselves anew. Narrating our own story, which is also God's story, back to ourselves. Because that's the powerful part, telling and retelling stories that we're a part of so that we're reminded we are also a part of something much bigger, that we belong to a God who redeems, who transforms, who delivers, who uses the courage of ordinary people in ordinary, fallible communities to turn the world upside down. Now, Christians historically have approached deliverance less at a community level and more at an individual level, but both elements are always there. Individual stories add up to communities transformed. Now, dancing around in sequins in a house of worship to retell a Bible story is so far outside of what many of us grew up with, but that's okay. The world is wide enough for many forms of storytelling. So I invite you this week to think about, have you ever experienced having your own story narrated back to you in a way that was powerful? How have you witnessed God at work through ordinary people? In the Bible, in art, here at Jubilee, in your own life, in the larger community? Which parts of the Bible do you read and think, that's my story? What does telling and retelling these stories look like for you? I think we all have our own stories of a world turned upside down. Let's think about how to share them so that we can say with the psalmist, I have not hidden your saving help within my heart. I have spoken of your faithfulness and your salvation. I have not concealed your steadfast love and your faithfulness from the great congregation.